This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Juliana Potts, CEO of the Mead Institute. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. Learn more about the benefits of the sugar industry to the nation at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with the Mead Institute's Juliana Potts next. America's 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers produce sugar under some of the world's strictest safety, labor, and environmental standards. The industry also supports 151,000 jobs across more than two dozen states. The farmer, family, and employee-owned sugar companies pay workers fair wages and offer good benefits, including union jobs in rural and urban communities. Together, farmers and workers provide a reliable domestic sugar supply chain for both food manufacturers and grocery store shoppers. A strong bipartisan coalition in Congress supports sugar policy, which is the safety net for sugar producers in the Farm Bill. The sugar program is designed to have zero cost to the taxpayer and has the flexibility to allow for a reliable supply of sugar throughout the year. Sugar policy ensures Americans are not dependent on unreliable foreign supplies, which would displace American farmers and jobs and jeopardize domestic food security for this essential ingredient. For more, visit the American Sugar Alliance at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. In celebrating 120 years of leadership on behalf of America's meat companies, the group formerly known as the North American Meat Institute offered a new name, logo, and identity last week in Washington. The new brand identity of the Meat Institute will be rolled out this week at the annual meat conference in Nashville. CEO Juliana Potts says the American meat industry is modern, open, and inclusive.
We believe that our new logo, our simplified name, yet throws back to all of the iterations before that you mentioned. We believe that the new look really represents us better as a modern, open, transparent industry and a modern, open, transparent organization that wants to collaborate across the supply chain and across all of agriculture and food.
I note that you are the Meat Institute, yet the two verbs in your mission statement are nourishing and sustaining, almost in parallel.
Yes. Doesn't that make you feel good? Nourishing gets to the food that we put on people's tables, are part of the opportunity to do that, the privilege of doing that. Our member companies produce, in our part of the supply chain, our member companies produce wonderful, wholesome, nutritional animal protein products, and we're so thrilled to be able to nourish people. And then sustaining, we have a sustainable industry. We will be sustainable into the future economically and by being connected with the entire supply chain. We intend to sustain our producers, our suppliers, our customers, and consumers well into the future. And we're really excited to highlight our sustainability and our ability to nourish folks.
Now, some don't believe that meat production, consumption go along with sustainability. So what's the meat industry's sustainability story, and what are your goals leading into even 2030?
Well, thank you for that opening, Jeff, because we've talked before about what we are, our vision for the future, what we call our protein PACT, P-A-C-T as an acronym for People, Animals, and the Climate of Tomorrow. That is a five-area focus for customers and consumers to identify, you know, their values with how the meat industry is continuing to improve in food safety, animal welfare, environmental impact, worker safety, and nutrition and health. Those are five very, very important areas for families in sustaining themselves and their values around those issues, we identify with, and that's where we are showing how we are continuously improving through the collection of data and the credibility that we gain from collecting the data and then telling people what we're doing to improve.
Is this a farm to plate journey?
We have partners in the entire supply chain that are working with us. So yes, it is really focused on what are the livestock groups doing in their industry when it comes to, say, emissions reduction. And their good work, say through the U.S. Roundtable for Sustainable Beef or the National Pork Board, We Care. We take and combine efforts upstream and then downstream. We have relationships and discussions ongoing with retailers, with food service, restaurants, and their interest in providing the same kind of information that we're collecting and that our suppliers are collecting to the ultimate consumer. And really, it's only when you can put all of it together that we get to tell a story that starts on the farm and goes all the way to your kitchen table or your restaurant.
So where does sustainability rank within price and quality with consumers when they approach the meat case?
Consumers are very highly attuned to taste, quality, value, so price, and also sustainability. But with anything like this, they all work in tandem. If price goes up, that can affect choices, but there are great opportunities within the conversations that we're having about animal welfare and about climate and about worker safety that we can enhance when a consumer is making a decision, enhance their understanding of how the meat industry is meeting their own sustainability goals. And so still, price, quality, taste, availability all rank higher in most cases than sustainability when it comes to what you put in the grocery cart. But sustainability is incredibly important, all of the aspects that we talked about, in helping consumers understand how their meat is produced and feel good about it and trust the way it comes to their table.
Is it wrong to assume that as the industry concentrates on sustainability, that their efforts toward sustainability will increase the price of the product?
There are trade-offs. In every conversation that we're engaged in throughout all the work that we do, all the regulatory oversight of the meat industry, all of the labeling issues, I mean, from pillar to post, regulatory enhancements, let's say, over, you know, in how our food is produced, often have added costs. So it's always a trade-off to look at sustainability as a win-win. You know, you want to do things in your business to reduce your expenses. For example, you know, reducing your water use or energy use can reduce your expenses, and that's also consistent with being more sustainable. And so I think that most of the time we are looking for the business case for our members to be a responsible business, to think about the ways in which, and catalog the ways in which their business decisions are having a positive sustainability impact, and then being able to talk about those things and tell the story is what the Meat Institute is attempting to do with Protein Pact. If the animal welfare and the some things like Prop 12, if some of the things that really change how a particular product through supply and demand is going to be made available, and the price of something in California, like a pound of bacon, has gone way up, which means that demand has come down because, of course, consumers are price sensitive. Then you really see the trade-off between some animal welfare regulation and what's available in the grocery store that affects price. Those are the kinds of trade-offs that people are making in some cases. But in general, sustainability can be a win-win, and that's what we need to be talking about.
Does the U.S. meat industry's effort towards sustainability, is it opening the door to more global markets?
It is opening the door to more global markets. We work very closely with the U.S. Meat Export Federation. In fact, USMEF is a partner with the Meat Institute and others in Protein Pact. And it gives our markets around the world confidence when they can hear about what producers here and processors here in the U.S. and in Mexico and Canada are doing to ensure a more sustainable product. It's, you know, different areas of the world have different sensitivities and are different levels of discussion in their own countries with consumers and the level of impact that some of those things have. We just know to be the most sustainable in the world, we have an advantage, and being able to talk about that means being able to get the data that we are collecting from our members, from our suppliers, and then downstream with our customers as well. And so we're really excited to be able to answer those kinds of questions, whether they come from our foreign markets, whether they come from investors or bankers or wherever they might come.
The Biden administration has offered change to the Packers and Stockyards Act, and they were targeting competition. So the question is, the regulations that they offered, have they hit the mark?
No. The new regulation that was just issued is not going to have any impact on increasing competition. The most recent rules are, frankly, more government interference in the marketplace. What they have done is take federal tort law and jammed it into an antitrust statute. And our position is that there are laws to deal with discrimination and retaliation and those types of things other places. They don't need to be enhanced in a Packers and Stockyards rulemaking. Of course, anything that looks like discrimination or retaliation should not be tolerated. It just doesn't belong in an antitrust statute. So we don't believe that this is going to do anything to enhance competition. And in fact, it's just going to produce a lot of litigation and will be a real boon to lawyers. No offense to lawyers. I am one.
Do the regulations offered prevent rewards for those meat producers who do a better job, who have a better product to sell, for being rewarded for those efforts?
Well, in the future, we expect the administration to issue another rule under Packers and Stockyards that will say that the parties, if you are a producer and you believe that you have been unfairly treated and you want to go to court. So in that case, if you don't have to demonstrate harm to competition in order to sue a packer, that's going to have an adverse effect on the kind of contracts that will be offered to producers. And those contracts, which are also called alternative marketing agreements, have been excellent ways for producers to be rewarded for value-added ways of producing their animals. So you think grass-fed or any never-ever kinds of claims, things that are a premium, including sustainability claims. If the contracts go away because the harm to competition standard is removed from the rule, that's going to be bad for producers. Then there won't be the same ability to reward producers for the value-added systems that they have put in place in order to get more for their animals. it comes down to what kinds of claims can be made that would be appealing, you know, to a customer that would be a value add. And if those can't be guaranteed through contracts from the packer back to the producer, that's going to harm the whole system. And so we think that the deluge of litigation that will come when you remove the harm to competition standard under the packers and stockyards rule is going to be really devastating. The consumer is the one that's going to be hurt ultimately, because more litigation is threatened when you make changes and you can't treat people differently without getting sued, which is what we believe is the end result of these changes. Then you're not going to treat people differently. There's not going to be an incentive for a better product, and I think over time we're going to see quality decline, and that is why I believe our producer organizations, who are our partners, also agree with us that this is not good for producers, and it's not good, you know, for those particularly who have been rewarded for the investments that they've made to their operations. Those aren't going to be recognized anymore, and so we feel like this is bad for all parties, including and most especially consumers.
But at the same time, there should be perhaps a mechanism that if a company is discriminating against a producer, not necessarily because of performance, but for some other means, that they would have avenue to be able to challenge the relationship.
Absolutely. There is a way under the Packers and Stockyards rules as they stand now to challenge what could be, you know, adverse behavior by a packer to a producer. Those rules exist. Secretary Vilsack, under the Obama administration, they've tried this before. The courts disagree with the direction they're going. I think there are something like 8 appeals decisions on this topic. The statute doesn't support what they're doing. So if they in fact, and I'm, again, this is prospective, if they in fact remove the harm to competition standard as part of what a plaintiff would need to show, it will really enhance the number and the type of lawsuits that will come that will be overwhelming to the orderly way in which a lot of the livestock have been marketed through contracts and incentivizing the kind of value-added product that we have seen and come to appreciate as consumers.
What benefits do you see from the USDA's product of the USA or made in the USA voluntary label? Does born, raised, slaughtered, and processed in the U.S. resonate with consumers?
There was a study, I believe, done in the lead-up to this that demonstrated some positive impacts. However, it is a voluntary label, and to this point, there had been no changes for 30-something years. So we believe that the market will dictate how this label will be used. The market will dictate how well consumers will understand the change that's been made and whether it will impact their buying decisions any more than in the past. It's voluntary. We're glad it's voluntary. Canada and Mexico, you know, retain the ability to retaliate, and so they're watching very closely, even though it is voluntary, whether there will be sort of a de facto mandatory use of it, but we'll see.
Are short cattle numbers a concern for some of your members?
Yes. We have the smallest cattle herd since 1951, I believe, at this point. And for sure, you know, we've got a lot of capacity that has come online in the last couple of years. Expansions at existing plants, new plants being built. And so just as the cattle herd was shrinking, we've got more capacity. And, of course, that means that cattle prices are higher than they've been since 2014, 15. And it's a hard time for the packers right now. Those kind of cycles based on supply and demand change. And so as the cattle herd is built up again, certainly the fundamentals of this market will change as well. And we've seen that, you know, over time. The cattle herd has been affected by a number of things, but most certainly drought. And so that is a bigger issue. We are seeing the issues of changes to the weather, changes to the climate, and how we deal with that going forward is something we're going to all have to be contending with.
Julianne, is the meat industry concerned today about Proposition 12, and is there a concern about the future for the way that it was promulgated?
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's a difficult question in that many of our members have already invested in the time since it was passed in becoming Prop 12 compliant. But going forward, and what we said at the time of the litigation was if every state were to pick a different standard by which they wanted their animal protein produced, we would be in a world of hurt. Having voters vote on something in one state and another state and another state, if they all turned out to be somewhat different, would really be devastating and expensive and incompatible with having you know, a unified economy trade between the states. So in that way, Prop 12 and the litigation that followed really tipped the domino over to this kind of thing happening again. Other types of ballot initiatives, other types of legislation. And we're not the only industry that's talking about patchwork regulation. We're seeing other things out of California that are problematic for all kinds of industries in food and agriculture. So there's that. We also would like to say if there's going to be, if we do address this in the future, it's going to have a national component to it. So whatever that looks like, if it's preemption or something else, we're going forward to prevent having a patchwork of regulation, a patchwork of requirements. We're going to have preemption or something like that.
Julianne, on behalf of the meat industry, what do you need from Washington? And what do you not need from Washington?
I'll tell you what it doesn't need from Washington is more manipulation of the marketplace. There are lots of policy proposals in Congress. Packers and Stockyards regulation represents this. It's a way to take free enterprise and a free marketplace and impose so many restrictions and regulations that it really doesn't represent true competition. And so we would love to see Congress agree that that is not the way to encourage businesses to invest and grow.
What about labor?
Labor continues to be a huge challenge for our industry. We have made labor one of the highest priority issues long range that we are working on as an industry organization. Many, many facets to how we address the problem. Our members have recently made their pitch to the House Agriculture Workforce Working Group, bipartisan working group. And we were very pleased to see in their report, including meat processing and other food processing in H-2A and other visa-type programs that have traditionally been limited to farming and not extended to processing. And being included in that is a big step. We realize that the House Ag Committee does not have the authority to make that happen, but they're speaking to it is very, very important to us. Immigration reform obviously would be a wonderful thing for our industry, but given the politics, we're not going to hold our breath on that one. But we would support making labor available through special visas and whatever means we have, because we really continue to have a shortage around the country from everyone that I talk to, large and small.
Well, Juliana Potts, we want to thank you for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. Congratulations on the new name and the new logo and the concentrated direction of Nourishing Today and Sustaining Tomorrow. Thanks for being here, and you know that the end of the program offers you an open mic.
Thank you, Jeff, so much. I just want to say that our industry is in a growth mode, looking through all of the lenses that we have now in front of us. So our brand, our evolution of the way we look for our constituents is really a reflection of the good work that our members are doing each and every day to sustain families, to nourish families, and to think about their own responsibility as businesses, as being responsible businesses, to keep food on the table, but also to protect the environment, the workers, the animals. We're just so proud of what they do. And so I appreciate the opportunity, as always, to tout what our members are doing. They're wonderful companies, all of them, doing good work, and we really appreciate the opportunity to represent them here in Washington.
Our thanks to Juliana Potts, CEO of the Meat Institute, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. Learn more about the benefits of the sugar industry to the nation at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Daly.